That brings us to Unit 3, which some students consider the most difficult of the units. Not all students, but some do. I don't know why that is, actually, but one reason might be that this is the biggest dose of physiology that we get, or actually, the better word is biochemistry. The second and third chapters of the units are about specific biochemical processes, and so maybe that makes it difficult. But one nice thing about this is that when we get to those two chapters, that will be an ideal time, if you haven't done it so far, if you haven't taken my advice on the website, it will be the ideal time to try studying by giving your own lectures out loud without looking at anything. And that's because it is a process. There's a certain chain of events, has a beginning and an end. And so you should be able to explain everything from beginning to end without looking at anything to prove to yourself whether you're ready for the test or not. If you haven't tried that, do it. The first slide of the chapter we're looking at right now is not a specific process. This is an introductory chapter introducing us to some background information that will be important for the next two chapters. This is an introduction to metabolism. This chapter is, I think that's the name of it from this book. And what we're seeing in schematic representation here is an example of a biochemical pathway. A biochemical pathway is not a single reaction. It's multiple chemical reactions, daisy chained, meaning that the output of the first reaction, whatever it is, in this case A, gets turned into B, then serves as a reactant. That product of the first reaction serves as a reactant for the second reaction, which turns it into a product, in this case C, which then serves as a reactant in the next reaction, and so on, for however many reactions there are. There's nothing magic about three reactions. That's just showing you as an example. But it's an end-to-end arrangement, a serial arrangement of chemical reactions. And therefore, when you talk about the entire pathway, you can talk about an input, the starting molecule, and then an ultimate product, comes out of the final reaction. And so A, B, C, D here just represent anything. They're not actual things, of course. But notice that there is an arrow between each, indicating that individually those are chemical reactions. Chemical reactions are parts of a biochemical pathway. And you shouldn't be surprised at this point to realize that reactions that occur in cells, biochemical reactions, are catalyzed reactions, which is why you see enzymes listed here. All right? Keep in mind what enzymes are. They are proteins that operate as catalysts. And a catalyst in general is something that drastically speeds up a chemical reaction without actually being a reactant. And usually it's several million times faster, the chemical reaction, if it's catalyzed versus if it isn't. That's actually an important point. A catalyzed reaction doesn't have to be catalyzed. The chemical reaction is possible without the catalyst. It's just going to be a hell of a lot slower. And we're not talking about only biochemical reactions. This occurs, this is true for any given chemical reaction in industry or whatever. But for biology particularly, if the reaction is not catalyzed, then chances are very high that it's not going to happen soon enough for the cell to remain alive, and therefore for the organism to remain alive. And so we don't have enzymes just to make things quicker for convenience. We have enzymes because without them, the reactions would be so slow that they effectively wouldn't be happening, and therefore life couldn't exist. This is why enzymes exist in general. But an important thing that you see also on this slide is that individual chemical reactions, like the ones in this pathway, require their own enzymes. So enzymes are specific. There isn't one master protein that can act as a catalyst for any reaction that can occur in that organism. You would not want that to be the case, even if it might seem convenient. Why would you not want that to be? Why don't you want a master enzyme?
In the catalyzer reaction, then you want to be slow.
That's right. You would lose control, right? A cell never should be running all of its possible chemical reactions at any given moment. It should only be running the reactions that are appropriate for the conditions at that time. And some reactions do opposite things. So if you ran them both, you'd be working against yourself, right? By having a separate, specific enzyme for each individual reaction, that gives the cell exquisite control over what actually happens biochemically. So it's kind of good that they are slow without the enzyme, because if you can turn the enzyme on and off, you're effectively turning on or off the corresponding reaction that it catalyzes. You can keep things from happening and cause things to happen that you want to happen. All right? It's also important to note that the enzymes here, which are just generic, if this were real, they would have specific names, but they're listed above the reaction arrows, notice. And that's not just because they fit there. It reminds you that enzymes are not reactants. They don't get turned into products. Reactants and products are shown on one side of the arrow or the other. An enzyme is always put above the arrow, schematically, to show that it's actually not a reactant and is not actually necessary, but is useful, as I said. And so it doesn't get turned into anything. This is an important thing about catalysts in general, not just enzymes, which are biological catalysts made out of proteins, but any catalysts. They not only speed up reactions, but because they don't get turned into anything in the process, they're still there to be reused if there's more reactant that needs to get turned into product. You know, people nowadays are busy stealing catalytic converters off of vehicles, right? Because they're valuable, because platinum is the catalyst in them. Platinum is more valuable than gold, so that's why people get on their back and hacksaw them off your vehicle and sell them. But if nothing goes wrong with them, they last because the platinum doesn't run out. It's acting as a catalyst, turns bad gases into less bad gases, which is why they're there, and in the process is ready for more. It doesn't get used up. Neither do enzymes that are acting as catalysts. Let's go to slide 2 and talk about energy. This whole unit deals with energy. And energy is a little bit hard to get a grasp of. A lot of textbooks will define energy as the capacity to do some work, which is true. And work, physically speaking, according to physics, is the application of a force through a distance. But energy can allow work to be performed. And although there are many different forms of energy, like chemical energy, solar energy, so on. There are two major categories of energy based on whether the energy is being used at the moment. And does anyone know those two categories? Yeah. Right. Potential and kinetic energy are the two major categories that we're looking at here with this example slide. Now, potential, the word, you know, if you say that some person has potential, that means that there's a possibility there for something to occur, right? Potential energy is energy that can be used, but at the moment it's not being used. That's why textbooks refer to it as stored energy. And a good example of potential energy that we've already talked about many times is a gradient. A gradient is an example of potential energy. It's not being used at the moment, but can be. Kinetic, on the other hand, is kinetic energy, is energy that is being used, energy of motion. And this word kinetic comes from the same root as cinema, which means moving pictures. Kinetic art is art that moves, like a mobile, for instance. So kinetic energy is energy that is being used at the moment. And the reason this diving platform is shown is to give you an example of the fact that potential energy can be converted into kinetic energy. Kinetic energy can be converted into potential energy. For instance, climbing these stairs doesn't come for free, right? You have to put work into climbing these stairs. So you're using kinetic energy to climb the stairs, but you're building up potential energy. This is another example of a gradient, but this is a gravitational gradient. The higher you get from the surface, the steeper the gradient is. All right, so you're investing your body with gravitational potential energy by climbing. That converts your kinetic energy of climbing into the potential energy of your position above the surface. And then if you intentionally dive or fall off, the reverse will happen. Your potential energy will be turned into the kinetic energy of you moving faster and faster as you approach the water downward. You're going down the gradient, right? Down the potential energy gradient, the gravitational gradient. So there's an interconversion between these two categories all the time. Now, to slide 3, more about energy. What we have here is a couple pictures to introduce two laws of thermodynamics. Thermodynamics is a very important science within chemistry and physics and biology that has to do with energy transactions. So it's really important in this unit specifically. And you can see here that the first and second law of thermodynamics are listed. Well, those aren't the only laws of thermodynamics. In a different course, where you cared not just about biology, but about all of thermodynamics, you would learn 4 laws of thermodynamics. But what we're going to restrict our attention to are called the first and the second law. Now, you might think the other two would be called the third and fourth law. That would be a reasonable assumption, but it's actually wrong. Because after the first and second law and the third law were laid down, they realized actually there's something more basic that we need to stick in the front. But they didn't want to rename these laws that already had the names. So the four laws are actually the zeroth law, the first law, the second law, and the third law. And so in this course we're going to ignore the zeroth law and the third law. All you need to know about are the first and second. And the first law of thermodynamics is often called the law of conservation of energy. It states that energy cannot be created or destroyed, but it can be transferred and transformed. Now, when I say that energy can't be created or destroyed, that means in the universe, which is everything, there is a certain constant amount of energy. That constant amount does not change. That's why it's a constant. All right? So energy doesn't get created or destroyed in the universe. But I said that it can be transferred and transformed. Transferring energy refers to moving that energy from one body to another. And body here doesn't necessarily mean an organism. Body means some object, any object in the universe. Like the cue ball and the one ball or whatever is on the front of the rack when you break in billiards. That's a transfer of energy. Right? I also said that energy can be transformed, though. That refers to energy changing from one form to another. And that's actually what this picture's kind of illustrating. This predator is eating this prey. Well, that food, you know, whether we eat this way or buy something from the store, the food that we are eating is full of chemical energy that exists as the bonds between the atoms making up that stuff. And this unit is devoted to largely devoted to talking about how we get that energy out of those bonds. But there's chemical energy, chemical potential energy in food that organisms take in. Well, it can then be transformed into heat, for one thing. Light energy, which is received by photosynthetic organisms, plants and bacteria that are photosynthetic, algae, transform light energy into chemical energy and so on. So that's what I mean by transforming, a change in the form of energy. The second law of thermodynamics is concerned with something that we call entropy. Entropy, if I wanted to give you just one word as a synonym, I would use disorder. Entropy, roughly speaking, is disorder. And what the second law says is that the entropy of the universe is always increasing. The universe, in other words, is gradually and continuously becoming more and more disordered. If you think back to the very first slide in this term, I think it was the first slide, when we looked at seven major things that organisms share, one of those was a high degree of order. Remember that? I think it was a flower was the picture. Organisms in general have very high order. They're not just random collections of things. And so that comes not for free. The it's not a violation of the second law of thermodynamics that organisms exist and have very high degree of order. Because for that order to be created and maintained in an organism, which is just one little subset of the universe, the rest of the universe, the surroundings, have to get a little bit more disordered than the amount of order you're adding to that little subset. So when you consider the entire universe, the overall disorder is always increasing. Entropy is always increasing. Another thing that the second law tells us is that in any energy transaction, like a chemical reaction, for instance, some energy gets lost as heat, which is why you see heat bars coming off of this cap while it's running. It received its energy by eating, right? Some of that energy goes into propelling it by operating its muscles. But heat energy is, when I say lost, I mean that it's not available to do any work. And this is the same thing that happens in an internal combustion engine, which unfortunately we're still using. An engine runs off of chemical energy in the gasoline or the diesel fuel. That some of that energy, but actually very little of that energy, actually goes into propelling the vehicle down the road. A hell of a big chunk is just lost as heat, which is why the engine is not going to run very long unless it has a dedicated cooling system just to keep it from seizing up because it gets so hot. That's all wasted energy in terms of the goal of propelling. So what I'm saying is that any energy transaction is never 100% efficient. It's impossible to have all 100% of the energy available put into actual work. Some of it gets wasted as heat. All right? Including in any biochemical reaction, which is just an example of a transaction. Okay. Now to four. Some more definitions to talk about in this slide.
Thank you.
First is free energy. Now, free energy, of course, is energy, but it's potential energy. It's potential energy that's available to do some work, right? As I've already discussed potential energy to be. Free energy gets the obvious symbol G. I'm being facetious. You would think it would be, maybe be F. G stands for Gibbs. It's Gibbs free energy, really, formally speaking, but we usually just say free energy. But that's what G stands for. Now, before I go on, I need to give you a couple more definitions. We talked about laws of thermodynamics. I need to define thermodynamic system as a phrase. A thermodynamic system can be just about anything you want it to be, as long as you define it. But it is some subset of the universe. For instance, an individual chemical reaction, if you define it that way, can be a thermodynamic system. An entire organism can be a system. A house can be a system. A thermos, whatever. Okay? As long as you define it. But when you do define a thermodynamic system, whatever it is, that divides the universe into two subsets. The universe is the entire set. That's everything, right? A thermodynamic system is some subset of the universe. That's one of the two things that you divide the universe into when you define the system. And then everything else, collectively, is called the surroundings. All right. So the thermodynamic system plus the surroundings equals the universe. There are different categories of thermodynamic systems. One of which is open, another is closed, and you might think, well, something's either open or closed, but there's a third category. Well, actually, let me hold off on that because I have a slide to give you to go along with those. It'll make it easier. As long as you know that a thermodynamic system can be just about anything, I can go on with this slide, which shows you actually three systems. Three, and when I just say system here, I really mean thermodynamic system. These are just examples, though. But in each of these systems, it's showing the system before at the top and after at the bottom. So there's a time passage. All right. Now, G is free energy at the moment. Free energy of the system, whatever it is, at the moment. So it's a particular value at a particular point in time. All right. Well, we've already used delta notation in this course, right? Which refers to a change in some value. And so I need you to realize that G is not the same thing as delta G. Delta G doesn't make sense unless you are comparing two different times, right? Because delta is about before and after. So delta G equals G final minus G initial. Just like change in mass, delta potato's mass was the mass final minus the mass initial, right? Since each of these has a before and an after, these three examples of a system, you can compute a delta G for each of these. If you know the values for G before and after. And also, just like I was explaining for the potatoes, it's important to define it this way. Not initial minus final, final minus initial. Because if the value of G goes down, which means the final will be smaller than the initial, defining it this way means small minus large is going to end up with a negative value for delta G. Is that all clear? Well, then, if a delta G has a negative value, that tells you a lot of information. It means that the free energy is going down. And that's true for each of these examples. The guy falling off of the diving board, his free energy, which is his gravitational potential energy, before, when he was higher, is going down because he's using some of that. That energy is going into his kinetic energy. So he's losing potential energy, right? He's losing free energy. And therefore, the delta G is negative here. This is a gradient, a concentration gradient in the middle. So at time zero, or before, you have a high concentration of these purple particles, and then they do what concentration gradients do, right? They dissipate by diffusion. They spread out into the available space. Well, this brings up an important point that high G values correspond to greater instability. To have a high G value makes you unstable. And that's because thermodynamic systems tend to go to a situation in which free energy is minimized. Right? He's not nearly as likely to fall off of the surface as he is off of this high platform. The platform is more unstable. This is an unstable situation for the gradient, for the concentration, right? Because these particles are not going to stay in this position. You'd have to force them to do that. They are more stable when they can just basically fall down their energy hill, so to speak. Go to a lower value of G. The third example is the breaking apart of a large complex molecule into smaller ones. The reason that it goes from less stable to more stable has to do with what we call degrees of freedom. When this large molecule exists, the individual constituent atoms are locked into a certain position with respect to the entire molecule. The molecule can move around in space, so that's some degree of freedom, but the individual atoms have to go wherever the molecule dictates them according to their position in that molecule. Do you see what I'm saying? On the other hand, if you break it into smaller chunks, then each chunk has its own way it can go. And so there's higher degree of freedom here. This is a more stable situation when you have these smaller particles moving around than when you have one big chunk. So each of these represents a decrease in G, a decrease in free energy, which is the same thing as saying that in each of these systems, the delta G is negative. Okay, now, I can't remember what the next slide is. Okay, yeah. I also need to give you some more definitions before we leave this. There are three sets of antonyms that I need you to think about. Antonyms are pairs of words that have opposite meanings, right? Like on and off. There's three pairs, but they go hand in hand. They're not interchangeable, but they describe similar things. One pair has to do with whether or not a process is going to occur on its own or can occur on its own. All right? And so the two antonyms are spontaneous and non-spontaneous. A spontaneous process is one that is able to occur on its own. And when it comes to delta G, this is one of the major virtues of knowing whether it's a positive or a negative value. A negative value of delta G means that there is a decrease in free energy. Well, you already know from the first law of thermodynamics that energy doesn't get destroyed. The energy decrease when you have a negative delta G is what allows the process to occur. So a negative value for delta G tells you that that process is spontaneous, meaning that it can occur on its own. Well, notice diffusion is one of these examples. And I started in lab when we introduced diffusion by saying that energy is required to move those particles, right? But the energy is contained in the system. Now you know what a thermodynamic system is. The energy is the G And the change in energy is negative when you allow this to diffuse, because some of that free energy goes into moving the particles. It's a spontaneous process. Each one of these is spontaneous because each one of them is negative delta G. Well, it's spontaneous following the arrows. In other words, from top to bottom, it's spontaneous. If you wanted the reverse to occur, that would never happen on its own, because those would all be positive delta G's to go from the bottom to the top version. Those all involve an increase in G. The system has a low value of G. It ends up with a high value of G. Well, that energy has to come from somewhere, right? It doesn't just get created because you can't create energy. So it has to come from outside of the system. In other words, you have to supply external energy in order to make a process with a positive G happen. You'd have to push this guy upward. You'd have to force these particles to be highly concentrated. All right? Or you'd have to build this molecule. These aren't just going to self-assemble into this thing. You'd have to force it to happen. So that's one pair of antonyms, spontaneous, non-spontaneous. And we would use one of those two terms if what we're trying to describe is whether or not this process will occur on its own. Importantly, a spontaneous process does not necessarily have to happen anytime soon. And this is what I was referring to when I talked about the need for enzymes. There's plenty of catalyzed reactions occurring in cells that are spontaneous. They have a negative delta G, but they're not going to happen soon enough for you to stay alive. So spontaneous doesn't mean quick. It just means possible to happen on its own. All right, now, the next pair of antonyms have to do with metabolism. And you already know what metabolism means, right? What is metabolism? Now, maybe you don't know what metabolism is, but I've taught you what metabolism is. What is the definition? No idea, or you just don't want to say?
The sum of all.
Right. The sum of all the chemical reactions occurring within an individual, whatever that organism is. It could be one cell for a unicellular, or all of them. All of the cells in a multicellular organism. That's metabolism. Metabolism is life, because life is really just the chemical reactions. Okay? But that's the whole set, all of the reactions. There's a dichotomy, though, that we can cut this into. Two subsets that are mutually exclusive. They don't overlap, but they together make up the entire set called metabolism. The two subsets are anabolism and catabolism. These two, notice these words differ only in their prefaces, or prefixes, an and cat. You see these opposite prefixes in other words. For instance, anode and cathode from electricity are oppositely charged poles. In biology, there are fish that you can categorize as either anadromous or catadromous. A catadromous fish swims downstream to spawn. An anadromous fish swims upstream to spawn. Cat means down. And it's also the same prefixes as in cation and anion. Cat, like in catheter, means down. It's a tube that lets down or drains the fluid. Okay, well, catabolism refers to breaking larger particles into smaller ones. So this third thermodynamic system here on the right, this chemical reaction, is a catabolic reaction because you're breaking this big complex thing into smaller, less complex things. And that's half of metabolism. The other half is anabolism, which is the building up of larger, more complex things out of smaller, less complex things. So running this in reverse, this C chemical reaction, would be anabolic. Notice, though, doing that would mean that you'd have to increase the G, right? The free energy. And that's why it's never going to happen on its own. You would have to supply that G. Well, anabolic reactions are occurring in your cells all the time. It's an important part of your metabolism. But they have to be forced to happen energetically. And that's a big part of what we're talking about in general in this unit. So that's a second set of antonyms. Catabolic and anabolic would be the adjectives. Now, you would use one of these words if what you're trying to describe about the system is whether you're building something up or tearing something down, okay? As opposed to spontaneous or non-spontaneous, which is describing something else about the system. Then there's a third set of antonyms, which is based on what happens to energy. And those are exergonic and endergonic. Now, the ergon part of this means energy. And there's a unit in science called the erg, named for the same reason. Exo means out. Endo means in. So exergonic literally means energy out. In other words, an exergonic system is one in which energy is released. Or I should say an exergonic process. An endergonic process, on the other hand, must be supplied with energy. Energy in is what it literally means. So they're opposites of each other as well. And you would choose one or the other of these words if what you wanted to describe is what happens to the energy. So there's three things we can describe, right? Whether or not this process can occur on its own. Whether we're tearing things down or building things up. And which direction energy is flowing, either into the system or out of the system. Although there's these three sets of antonyms that I just defined, they correlate with each other. A spontaneous process is exergonic. It releases energy. A catabolic reaction is spontaneous. All right? The reverse is true, though, as well. A non-spontaneous process has to be forced to happen. It's endergonic. It corresponds to endergonic. And if something is being rearranged molecularly, non-spontaneous and endergonic correspond to anabolic. All right? Every one of these uphill ones is the one you would have to force to happen. So that would be non-spontaneous, endergonic, or anabolic. All right, that's a bunch of definitions. Now let's look at some pictures to compare exergonic and endergonic reactions. So a chemical reaction can be a thermodynamic system, like I said, you can define anything as a system. You just have to say what it is. So each of these is a reaction, top and bottom. And notice it's free energy that's on the y-axis. That's G. G has a specific value at a specific point in time, remember. So it's not delta G that's being plotted here. The y value is G. But it's plotted first for the system before the reaction occurs. And then it's plotted after. So you have two different values of G here, before and after, right? Progress of the reaction is really just another way of saying time. Before the reaction occurs and after it occurs. And that's true. The other graph below it is set up exactly the same way as far as the axes are concerned. The big difference, though, besides the colors, is that in the top, this reaction has a G value, or the system that this reaction is, has a G value that is lower at the end than what it started with. G goes down for this reaction, right? So the G value is whatever this value is here, and then for the products, it's this value, which is lower. Therefore, since you have a before and after value, you can compute delta G. Delta G graphically is just the distance between these two Y values, before and after. But since it's going down, and because of the way we define delta G, that means delta G calculates to a negative value. Well, this is an exergonic reaction we're looking at, which means energy is released. That's what the word comes from. And the energy that's released is why this delta G is negative. Okay? That energy that's released doesn't get destroyed or created. It gets moved from the system to the surroundings. Just the opposite for the blue graph. Here we have a before and an after value for G as well. The before is the reactants, the after is the products, G. But in this case, the system ends up with a higher G value. The products feature higher G than the reactants did, which is why this was never going to happen on its own, right? Because there wasn't that available energy in the system. You have to supply it from the surroundings. And this is why it's called an endergonic reaction, one that takes in energy. And if it doesn't take in energy, it's not going to happen. And this is what I meant by the correspondence between these antonyms. An exergonic reaction is spontaneous. Even if it doesn't happen anytime soon, it's still possible for it to happen on its own. Because it has that G value that's higher to start with. An endergonic reaction is never going to happen on its own. It's non-spontaneous. Doesn't mean it's impossible, though. We have endergonic reactions occurring all the time, as long as you supply energy from outside the system to make it happen. Okay, those are some more definitions. Now let's go to 6. And we can get back to thermodynamic systems. I started telling you that there were three categories of systems, but I stopped because I wanted to get to this slide. The three categories of thermodynamic systems are open, closed, and isolated. And I wanted to wait until this slide because there's an error in this slide, actually. First, let me give you the real definitions of these three. An open thermodynamic system is a system that is able to exchange both energy and matter with the surroundings. So open's a pretty good description of that, right? So energy can go from system to surroundings or surroundings to system, same with matter. A closed system is a system that can exchange energy with the surroundings but not matter. Matter is locked in the system, but energy can go in or out. And an isolated system is a system that can't exchange matter or energy with the surroundings. In other words, an isolated system is completely cut off from the rest of the universe. And that's why there's really no such thing as an isolated system, an isolated thermodynamic system. But just because there's no such thing doesn't mean it's not useful to have it as a concept. It's just not really possible, although there we can design, for instance, systems to be very close to an isolated system, which is exactly what a Dewar's flask is, or a thermos. It's designed in such a way, it's closed, first of all, because matter isn't going in or out of the thermos, right? But it's designed in such a way that the exchange of energy is made as little as possible. You can't really cut it off completely. If you did have a truly isolated thermos, then whatever temperature you put in there, liquid to start with, it's going to always be that temperature. You know from experience that given enough time, it's going to either lose or gain thermal energy depending on whether it's hot or colder than the surroundings. But anyway, that's what an isolated system means. It's just a concept within thermodynamics. And that's why this is an error when this book called this an isolated hydroelectric system. Why is it an error here? Looking at the picture. How?
The water generator at the center.
The water is not leaving.
The energy is.
What? How is it leaving?
Because it's turning the turbine right there.
Yeah, but that's part of the system.
It's turning off the light
bulb. Right. Light energy is being emitted. That's leaving the system. So this is not an isolated thermodynamic system. It's actually a closed system. All right. Publishers just got that wrong. But anyway, this closed hydroelectric system operates based on a gravitational gradient. You have two vats, one with more water in it than the other. The levels of the water are different. In other words, that's the gradient. Water always wants to fall downhill, just like other massive objects. And it's set up in such a way that if the water does go down its gradient, it will turn the turbine, which generates electricity, which is why the light is lighting.
Question. So, since that's technically non-isolated system, can that be classified as a closed?
No, it definitely is a closed system. And it's closed because no matter is going in or out. The water is in there to start with, and it can't get out. And that's why it's important that it's closed, because since it's closed, water is going to fall downhill only until the level in the two chambers is equal, right? It comes to equilibrium. There is no more gravitational gradient at that point. And therefore, no more tendency for water to move past the turbine to turn it. That's why the light goes out. This is a more stable situation, by the way, right? It has stabilized when the water comes to equilibrium. This is a less stable situation. It's what I meant earlier when I said less stable corresponds to higher G. And systems really kind of want, in a sense, to get to a lower G value if they can. They want to go to a more stable situation. That's why when you put in energy to make a room nice and tidy, it's not going to stay like that, right? It's going to tend to disorder. Okay. We still have a hydroelectric system in B, but this one is open. It's open because matter is being added and taken away, exchanged with the surroundings. But if you put in water at a rate that exactly equals how much is spilling past the turbine, and you let that amount out, then as long as you keep adding it, you'll keep turning the turbine, the light will continue to operate. These are given here not because we care about hydroelectric systems per se, but because they represent organisms. They potentially represent organisms. But which of these two, A or B, is the better representative of an organism?
B.
B. The important point here is that no living organism is a closed thermodynamic system. All organisms, in order to remain alive, have to exchange both matter and energy with the surroundings. And therefore, all organisms, thermodynamically speaking, are open systems. Well, that's true, but actually C is the best representative of organisms. This is a multi-step open hydroelectric system. What you might not notice right away is that the overall gradient from this first vat to this last vat is a change in level that's equal to the change in level when it's just one step. So the delta G, which is represented by that difference in levels, is the same for both B and C. But C uses multiple turbines where water flows to not all the way down to the final level, just a little step at a time, releasing energy a little bit at a time. The reason that this is analogous to an organism, which is going to be more clear when we get into the next chapter, is that when we use our fuels, when we get the chemical energy out of our fuels, which comes from what we eat in the case of animals, we don't burn those fuels like putting a match to a fuel would all at once. We don't release all of that energy at once. It would be unmanageable. It would not only be wasteful, but it would probably kill us. Instead, we release our energy. It's the same amount of overall energy, but we release it a little bit at a time so that it can be manageably collected in the form of ATP molecules, which can then be used to drive various non-spontaneous endergonic reactions that cells require. All right, now to seven. Speaking of which, is I just talked about ATP. We are looking at ATP here. What does ATP stand for? Yeah. Adenosine triphosphate, and we've already talked about it a little bit. What do you know ATP as? I mean, what is it an example of, based on what I've already taught you in a previous unit? It's what? It's not energy, it's a molecule. But what kind of molecule is it an example of? Why did we study ATP before? No, that's not what I'm getting at. All right, well, let's look at the components. Okay? It's called adenosine triphosphate, obviously, because there are three phosphates hooked to it. But if you didn't have any of those phosphates, if this is the entire molecule, that would be by itself adenosine. Look at what adenosine is made up of, though. Ribose, a pentose sugar, to which is attached adenine, a nitrogenous base. So what is ATP an example of? It is not a nucleic acid, because nucleic acids are polymers made out of subunits called what? No. What are the monomers?
Nucleotide.
Yes. ATP is an example of a nucleotide. We first encountered it when we talked about DNA and RNA. Because RNA, since we're using ribose for ATP, ATP it is a subunit that you can make an RNA nucleic acid out of. That's one of its important jobs. which by itself is indispensably important to life, because you can't live without RNA. But this nucleotide does another important set of jobs, which is by itself indispensable as well, and it acts as an energy-carrying molecule. Many textbooks describe ATP as the energy currency of the cell. We'll talk more about that reason, that definition is a good one, or a good analogy, in a minute. But let's talk more about this structure. Do you remember when I talked about nucleotides in general, that I said a nucleotide is if you have three things in place? You have to have a pentose sugar to which is attached a nitrogenous base, and also to which attached to that same sugar a phosphate, at least one phosphate. In this case, it's a string of three phosphates. But if you have those three things in place, then what you have is a nucleotide. What about when you have no phosphates and you just have the sugar and the nitrogenous base? What is that called?
It's a nucleoside.
It's a nucleoside, exactly. The same exact word with S instead of T, so be careful with that. Well, when I say ATP is a nucleotide, you can't tell from that word how many phosphates there are. There's at least one, otherwise it wouldn't be a nucleotide. But you can't tell from that word, right? Which is why it's more specific to call this a nucleoside triphosphate. Saying it that way tells you not only is it a nucleotide, but there are specifically three phosphates, not just some number one or greater. You see the difference? So yes, it's a nucleotide, but it's more descriptive to call it a nucleoside triphosphate. And getting back to its energy-carrying function, the reason that it's carrying so much energy is because it has three phosphates attached to it. The chemical energy in the bonds between the phosphates is usable energy. It's potential energy, potential chemical energy, that can be used, like any potential energy, but in this case, it can be used if that energy is released by splitting the bonds between the phosphates. And so we talk about spending ATP all the time, which is getting back to this analogy, calling ATP the energy currency of the cell. The reason this is a good analogy, and currency meaning money, right? It is a good analogy because, well, think about money for a second. Or think about your effort, your work, whatever you do to earn money, right? Very few people nowadays work at whatever they do directly for the things that they need in life. They don't work directly for a living space or for food or for clothing. Instead, what they directly work for is money, currency. That currency represents the energy that you spend in that work. In a sense, it stores it. But money, even though it's worthless by itself, you can't eat it or live on it, it's useful because you can spend the money on a great variety of things like housing, food, or whatever else. So it's very versatile, right? You don't want to have a separate job that you work at for housing and another job that you work at just for food. You want to have one job that gives you money that you can spend on anything. Similarly, in a cell, in an organism, the energy that we get, that the cell gets, extracts, the chemical energy from the molecules of food, or the molecules of nutrient that come from food, the fuel molecules, are what we get our energy out of. Like monosaccharides are the most important fuel molecules. Anyway, when a cell releases that energy of a fuel molecule, it burns the fuel to get the energy out of it. It does not directly use that released energy to do cellular work. And we'll talk about different categories of cellular work later in this chapter, but there's all kinds of things that cells have to do that require energy for them to be done. Collectively, all of those things are endergonic reactions, endergonic processes. There's all kinds of processes that are necessary for life but happen to be endergonic. Those are never going to happen, right, on their own. They're non-spontaneous. But they're vital. Without them happening, the cell will die. By definition of those processes being endergonic, the cell has to force them to happen by supplying energy. But what I'm trying to say is that a cell doesn't burn its fuel and directly use that released energy from the fuel to drive the endergonic processes. Just like we don't work at our job directly for the things that we need. Instead, a cell burns its fuels and uses the released energy to directly build ATP molecules, which are now storing some of the energy that was released from the fuel. Okay, this is like the paycheck, in other words. And just like your paycheck can be used to versatilely to buy all kinds of different things, ATP, storing the energy from the fuel, can be used when you release that energy again by spending the ATP. It can be used to power a great variety of endergonic processes in the cell. So it's an energetic middleman, ATP is, or middle person, I should say, in that the energy gets stored in it, the energy from the fuel gets stored in that ATP intermediary, and then can be released again to drive endergonic processes that the cell has to have happen, or it will die. This is why we say spend ATP. It's by analogy with currency. And the analogy, you know, the analogy makes sense even if you think of cash. But really, it's an even better analogy if you think of ATP as a debit card corresponding to a balance in a bank. And that's because a nucleotide, an energy-carrying nucleotide, can be carrying more or less energy, just like a balance can be higher or lower. ATP, because it has three phosphates, is carrying a lot of energy. And that's like the payday balance. It's a high balance at the moment. But you can spend some, if not all, of that. You can spend a little bit of it by taking off just one of these phosphates. And that will turn this from ATP into ADP, adenosine diphosphate, which is like the same debit card with just a lower balance. It's not as much spending power. It's not carrying as much energy. Okay. Let's look at that happening in slide 8. This is ATP on the top, as you see labeled. It's getting turned into ADP by cleaving off one phosphate. And so the phosphate, well, remember, I think I've said this before, but it's important. A P with a circle is a symbol for an entire phosphate group. It does not mean a phosphorus atom. P by itself is a phosphorus atom. P with a circle around it is really just shorthand for the phosphorus atom and the four oxygen atoms that make up collectively the phosphate group. Okay, so there's three on ATP by definition of ATP. One of them gets cleaved off, though. And notice it's listed as P sub I. The I stands for inorganic. Why is this inorganic phosphate all of a sudden? Right, organic means carbon has to be involved, right? Well, it was connected to, indirectly, a carbon skeleton here before an ATP. There's carbon in this. There's no carbon in this when it's on its own. So that's why it's called inorganic phosphate. And so cells just have a pool of inorganic phosphate all the time that is being added to and drawn from at any given moment. The other two phosphates are organic because they're still connected to the rest, to the nucleoside that has carbon in it. Okay, so no matter has been added or subtracted, as you're familiar with chemical reactions. You have the same amount of stuff before and after. But because you've broken this terminal phosphate-phosphate bond, that releases some chemical energy. That's why energy is also listed as a product. It's not a material product, but it's important. It's the whole reason you're doing this. Well, what kind of reaction is this for this to happen?
Hydrolysis.
It's a hydrolysis reaction, which is why water is required here. Because you have to stick an oxygen onto one thing, I mean a hydrogen onto one thing and an OH onto the other. And it's hydrolysis, as you should remember, is splitting a bigger thing into smaller things. So metabolically speaking, what kind of reaction is this? Right, but more specifically, what kind of metabolic reaction is it? It's catabolic, exactly. Catabolic reactions are exergonic. This is releasing energy. This bottom is the more stable situation, right? The delta G is negative, happening from top to bottom. And that energy doesn't get destroyed, it gets released. That's the utility of this. That's like spending your balance. That energy that's released, some of it will be wasted as heat because you can't get around the second law of thermodynamics. But some of that energy will be able to be put into the job of forcing some endergonic reaction to occur, something that the cell has to have happen. Right? You always have to force those things to happen. That's what some of the energy is going to be used for. Now, this is shown as a one-way reaction, but it's really two-way. This is reversible. You have to force it in the reverse, but it is reversible. You can do exactly the opposite. You can build an ATP by hooking an inorganic phosphate to an ADP, but you're going to have to put energy into it to make that happen.
Dehydration.
Right. And don't think of this as one way, because you have a pool, any given organism, but you as an example, has a pool of adenosine nucleotides. I'll just call them that way. The whole pool is not ATP. The pool is adenosine and some number of phosphates. Okay? There's three major forms: adenosine triphosphate, adenosine diphosphate, the only two we've talked about. But you could also keep spending here. You could cleave another phosphate off, and that would give you adenosine monophosphate, AMP, which in the currency or the debit card analogy is getting a dangerously low balance. So the pool I'm talking about of the adenosine nucleotides in your body consists of all three of these forms. But there's not much of it that's AMP, because that's a strong signal to the body. You're spending energy more than you're taking it in. You need to build up some more ATP. Most of your adenosine nucleotides are in either ATP or ADP form, and they're going back and forth between those by either running this downward or upward millions of times a second throughout your body. Because this is the energetic intermediary between the exergonic process of burning fuel to get energy and the endergonic processes that the cell requires that you have to force to happen. I just want to show you, well, no, that was the end of a different slide, so that's enough for that.